Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes producer and journalist Cyrus Farivar to discuss his new book, Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech, an insightful look at the implications for the future of privacy. Tuesday, June 12th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
It's Monday, June 4th, 2018. I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 396. Today on the show, counting the dead. How professionals in public health determine the human death tolls from war and natural disasters. Last week, researchers from Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and other institutions released an estimate of 4,600 deaths from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. That number by far surpasses the government's count of 46 deaths from the storm that ravaged Puerto Rico last September. How do public health professionals make such estimates? Our guest today is from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's led similar projects to estimate the cost in human lives from war. Gilbert Burnham, founder of the Center for Humanitarian Health at Hopkins, led the team that estimated that as many as 655,000 Iraqis may have died after the U.S. invasion of their country in March 2003. That estimate was later affirmed in a follow-up survey of hundreds of Iraqi households. More recently, Dr. Burnham was the senior author of a report on human mortality during the nine-month battle to liberate the Iraqi city of Mosul from the Islamic State. I think there were a lot of suspicions that 46 or 48 dead in Puerto Rico from Hurricane Maria was probably a low estimate. It didn't sound realistic to a lot of people. There was a lot of suspicion about it. But then last week, when the news comes out of the Harvard researchers estimating more than 4,000 deaths, some people may wonder, well, how do you make that kind of a leap? How did you go from such a small number to such a high number? So what was your response when you saw that report of that estimate from Puerto Rico?
I wasn't surprised because we really have two different types of numbers. We have the number that the state had, which were the death certificates that were sent to them where there was some direct connection with the hurricane. The tree falls on the car or the building collapses or whatever. Then we have the Harvard data, which were people actually going out and inquiring at the household what happened. And what they found was, while there were some that were directly affected by the hurricane trauma from various drowning, for instance, what they actually found was that there were a lot of people that died because they couldn't get their medicines, or someone in the household had a heart attack and they couldn't get to the hospital, or they got to the hospital and there was no electricity there, or there was no medicine, or for some reason that they didn't have access. And the other thing they found, which I think needs further exploring, is there's a large number of households in which there was only one person there. And if that one person died, then there was nobody there to report in this death. And this is something that we always deal with when we're dealing with mortality or death surveys, and that's called survivor bias. The dead are not there to report in, and they miss things when that happens. And furthermore, when you're getting death certificates that directly relate to trauma, as the state did, that's one thing. But you don't get death certificates that clearly assign responsibility of the heart attack to the hurricane. And then furthermore, I think that doctors were a bit hesitant to really try to read between the lines and say, well, this episode of stroke or this episode of asthma was related to the hurricane. So that's a lot of assumptions that it's really not easy to make.
It seems like the primary model for these studies is, what was the mortality over the same period last year or over the last 10 years during the same period? Say you were looking from September, the time of Hurricane Maria, to March, the following March, and you looked at September to March, each of the last 10 years in Puerto Rico, you would come up with a number or mean or an average of something, right?
Right.
And you're comparing that to what you find during this period after a disaster.
That's a very logical way to do things, and I think we've looked at that in other studies, and that's a good assumption, because under times of stress, deaths from all causes rise. So the other thing I think to say in perhaps defense of the territorial health people in the time of Maria is, when you're dealing with major disasters, you have to set priorities. And record keeping is always one of the low priority items. And so, and it makes sense. So if you're dealing with life and death issues, people are going to be diverted from recording events, recording reports, or even making the initial reports from the hospitals. And then you can think also that if you're living in some remote village and you die, the priest buries you, and somehow we didn't get around to doing a death certificate because there's no electricity, there's nobody to receive it, and so forth. So I think that's on two accounts. One, that the record keeping was focused very much on trauma-related activities and our events. And I think the other hand, it was the fact that this was not a priority at this point. We had to decide what was the biggest priority, and this wasn't it.
Is it ever a priority, the deaths of civilians in war or in disaster? Okay, we need to know what that number is. Why? Just for the record, for historical sake, why?
Well, when we're looking at various causes of illness and various medical or health events, the issue of death is a situation where the definition is not arguable. You know, you're either alive or you're dead.
Right.
So it's not how many people got diarrhea or how many people died after they had a stroke, life or death. And so that's kind of a benchmark that we've used. And at the same time, in conflict situations or even in disasters, these are really hard to measure. And there's a lot of guessing going on. There's a lot of general estimates. And even the Harvard data, as people saw, has a big confidence or uncertainty interval. So we say that 4,000 some deaths were the most likely number, but it could be higher and it could be lower, and I personally believe it's probably higher than that. But
my question is, why do we want to know this? And I'm sorry if it sounds almost sophomoric, like it's obvious we should know how many people died from a disaster. In cases of war, I think for political reasons, it isn't something that's desired to actually know, say, how many civilians died in a conflict.
Well, I think we tend to measure all events by life and death issues, and deaths in earthquakes or deaths in volcanoes or deaths in flooding. These are things that we can really directly relate to. That's a standard measure that's been there over the centuries.
Okay. But in terms of war, for instance, I don't think civilian deaths is something our government or any government conducting a war, prosecuting a war, wants to spend a lot of time on.
Oh, exactly. We saw with the Iraq War, there was denial from the military for a number of years that the coalition forces were not collecting information on deaths. And then it turned out with WikiLeaks and so forth that indeed they were, and we had those data. But these are things that we're not really interested in. And then I think it also goes back to the Vietnam War, where the body counts were clearly inflated, and then people began to distrust these kind of accounts.
They were body counts of enemy dead,
right? Yes,
given
exactly.
By our government, right? Yeah.
But we have pretty good data on the deaths of our troops, and the whole process of collecting information on deaths and injuries among soldiers, this goes back to the 19th century. There was a coalition among European powers at that time to standardize the way that they recorded injuries, the way they recorded who got recruited, their sizes, their weights, then subsequently how they reported injuries and deaths. So that's been standardized for a long time.
To me, what's impressive about this, I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not in public health, but I am a reporter, and I've gone out and knocked on people's doors, asked questions, you know, sort of intruding on people's lives to ask questions.
Sure.
And police do this, anyone who's in an investigative role. In the studies that you've been involved in and led, and here in Puerto Rico, we see that they actually visit residences and ask questions. Some 3,000 residences across the island, the occupants of those were interviewed by these researchers. People think you can just extrapolate from some kind of magical data, but actually you need to interview people.
Yes, this is very much how we do lots of things. That's how the census is done. When we read data to say how many people are obese in America, do you think that they went around to measure all of us? No, they did a sample. They applied those numbers to the general population. They came up with a figure that estimated how many Americans are overweight. And we see the same thing when we're doing polling for presidential or congressional elections. You know, we'll measure a certain amount, and there are statistical ways that can give us levels of accuracy for that, and we'll measure those, and we'll be able to predict generally fairly well. We have some high visibility failures from time to time, but you know, we're pretty good at that. And so many other things about what people eat, where they go, how much they exercise, that's all based on sampling.
How did you get into this? I meant to ask you this before. I interviewed you some years ago after you did a study on the Iraq War.
Right.
But how did you get into these kinds of studies? What's the arc of your career that led you here?
It's a complicated one. I spent some time in the military. At the end of the Vietnam War, I was drafted. And so I learned a lot out of my time in the military, even though I was a conscientious objector. Then I moved to Africa, and I lived 15 years in Africa. And I became very much involved with the refugees from the Mozambican War, primarily because they had lots of leprosy, and I was interested in leprosy at the time. But then I became interested in the whole geopolitics of things, and the Mozambican War in southern Africa was a very complex issue with many players in it. And when I came to Hopkins, ostensibly to do quality improvement of health systems, which I still do involved with, I realized that nobody was looking at the public health issues in disasters, both natural disasters and conflict disasters. And so I thought this is a good time to start that. We got a little bit of money. We founded the center in 1998, and it's continued to grow, and we've been looking at a number of things, not just deaths. We've looked at illnesses. Now we're very much involved in Syrian issues and Iraqi issues on non-communicable diseases. But as you said earlier on, deaths are the things that that we can relate to. These are the things we measure. So we focus very much on that.
In the case of the Mosul study, how did you get into that? Was that initiated by Hopkins, or is there like sort of an international group that forms to do these things?
This is a private activity. And I have a friend in Baghdad at one of the universities, and he and I have done a number of studies over the years. And after Mosul was taken by the ISIS, I gave my friend Riyad a telephone call and said, Riyad, at some point, the military forces are going to retake Mosul from ISIS. And we should be there to find out what it was like to be under ISIS for however period of time it was going to be. So we began early on trying to figure out what we'd like to measure and to try to find the interviewers and try to work out our sampling process. So this was one of the situations where we had a lot of lead time, and we spent a lot of time thinking about it. And as a result, we were able to get Mosul interviewers. And the Arabic in Mosul has a kind of a unique accent. And so the people in Mosul will not talk to outsiders. But when the interviewers knocked on the door and greeted people with a Mosul accent, then they were ready to talk.
And they were doctors?
Yes.
So health professionals and doctors.
Yes.
So you were looking specifically at what kind of mortality there was after this period of, I guess we call it liberation.
Yes.
When there was an attempt to, by coalition forces, to get ISIL out of there.
We looked at a number of things. We looked at injuries and mortality. That was the high-profile thing. We also looked at what it was like to be alive during that period of time. What was life like in ISIS-controlled Mosul? And then we looked at the health-seeking behavior, the health behavior, and where people got their treatment and what kind of illnesses they had during that time. Mm-hmm. And then we did some very detailed studies on the health workers who stayed there during this period of time and what was life like there and what were their impressions. So this was a very interesting experience, and it was a very low-budget operation. I think we had donations from various sources that covered the cost of it, so it was done completely outside of Hopkins. And I think the whole study cost probably less than $20,000.
So what were the main findings?
Well, I think the main findings were that mortality or death during the time and injuries during the time of the liberation was far greater than it was during the time of ISIS occupation. We also found that the majority of deaths that occurred in West Mosul. This was the old part of the city, and this was where ISIS was making its last stand. And there we found that the death rates were huge. They were probably 15 to 18 times greater than they were during the time of ISIS occupation. And most of those were caused by airstrikes. Some were caused by artillery. And then there were a lot of kind of crude explosive devices that were being used, and it was hard to sort out some of those. But clearly airstrikes were the major cause of injury and death.
It reminds me of the study you did of the Iraq War.
Right.
And bombings that we carried out in urban areas. And this, of course, Mosul, another urban area, right, where people are living in close quarters. It just seems impossible to imagine that airstrikes could be so accurate, so pinpoint, that you would have limited collateral damage or deaths of civilians.
Well, I think the technology of airstrikes and even the technology of artillery shells, which can be guided to their destination, I think those have improved dramatically. But where our problem is, we don't have the intelligence on the ground, and we can perhaps pinpoint where the ISIS snipers are, where the fighting is going on, but right next to them are civilians. And so many of these people that were killed were probably killed as collateral damage on strikes to ISIS snipers or ISIS fighters. And so it means that the really crucial thing is the intelligence on the ground, so we know who's where and who's not in direct fire. But we also need to be aware that the weapons that we're using have a much higher kill rate or a much higher area of destruction than we had in the past. And so even though we're successful in hitting our target, there are a lot of other people in the area that may be affected. And this is particularly true in the urban areas.
A lot of people fled Mosul. So
yes.
your interviews with who was left behind.
Yes, and so this was our intention, and that's why we organized things in advance. So we wanted to be there as soon as possible so we could find people who were there during the entire period of time of ISIS, and these were not people returning after having been outside. And one of the lessons that was, I'm not sure we really have enough good information about what was the right approach, because in the earlier attacks of other locations in Al Anbar and in the areas that were controlled by ISIS, the Iraqi government urged people to leave the city as soon as possible, which they did, and many were killed. And in the case of Mosul, the government decided to adopt a different approach and urge people to stay behind, which they did, and many of them were killed. So either way, whether you ran or whether you stayed was a bad outcome.
You know, I mentioned politics earlier because I think entities, government or not, that are somehow responsible for the deaths of civilians, those entities do not want to spend a lot of time on this.
Right.
They don't want it known that civilians die at all. And in the case of a government and its response to, say, a natural disaster, the deaths of people because of delayed medical care, for instance, not something they would want to promote or even fund the research for.
Yeah,
that's my view of it. Excuse me.
No, I think there are a number of issues to unpack out of that, and we find this with both natural disasters and conflict-related disasters, and that is why spend money on something like this when you can spend money on providing direct assistance to the population? Mm-hmm. And this was the issue that came up with Puerto Rico. Why did Harvard get money to do this kind of thing when they could have been providing assistance? And George Washington University is cooperating with the territory in Puerto Rico to do a very detailed assessment of deaths that occurred in the 5 months after the hurricane. And this, from a public health standpoint, is critically important because we can measure what the impact of not getting the health system up and running rapidly again. And yet people are criticizing that, saying, oh, you should be spending more money just on the people and their immediate needs. But from a public health standpoint, having the data is invaluable. And if we're thinking about how to respond to the next hurricane in Puerto Rico, and there certainly will be one at some point, what are the vulnerabilities that we missed the first time that we can now address?
If you're going to learn anything,
yeah,
right?
This is the time to learn it.
Yeah. Speaking of learning, I'm curious, what do you teach? What do you train your students in?
Well, we have a number of courses that are related to humanitarian and emergencies and humanitarian response. And these include both natural disasters and conflict-related disasters. So we have a curriculum in the master's program that deals with humanitarian emergencies. And this goes right through from some of the basic kind of vulnerability and vocabulary issues and definitional issues in the beginning to looking at health systems, to looking at measurement methods. We have a course on food and nutrition in emergencies. And then we have issues related to human rights as well, because all of these things are wrapped up in this situation together. So that's at the graduate level. Now, increasingly, we've been doing MOOCs, or the massive online courses. And
yeah.
So we have one up and running on that. So we've had about almost 5,000 people have been on that in less than a year that's been up.
From all over the world.
Yes, all over the world, yeah. Indeed. Yeah. And now we're looking at expanding that. We've had a number of requests to expand into other areas of that. This was a very basic course to start with. Then we have a course every July, and also in January, which is called HELP, or Health Emergencies in Large Populations. And this is something we do with the Red Cross in Geneva. And that's now trained over the years probably close to 900 people from many places in the world. This is getting harder for us to do because getting visas to come to the U.S. Is really difficult. And we've had a couple requests from practitioners to come from Gaza and the West Bank, and those are routinely turned down now, so they can't get permission to attend.
Is that
the
right? Huh.
And if you're from a predominantly Muslim country, it's very hard to get a visa to attend these courses.
And yet we're in a period when there are all kinds of potential conflicts, especially in that part of the world. We're seeing more extreme weather, you know, more natural disasters affecting wider and wider areas and parts of the world that weren't as affected before. So
one of the things that I think we did really well, we had a very proactive program to encourage people from Nepal to come attend these short courses. And I think over the years, we probably trained 20 or 25 people from Nepal. And I hear from them regularly. They write articles. They send me information about how their exposure to public health issues has improved their response during the earthquakes in Nepal. So I think we can make contributions. But the contributions in preparedness and building systems and so forth, it's never as dramatic as the footage of people digging survivors out of buildings and so forth.
Mm.
When you're doing house-to-house surveys, people say, are you sure that people want to talk to you? Or maybe they've had all this emotional trauma and they don't want to have anybody else coming around and asking them questions about things. The interesting fact is everybody wants to talk. And in fact, the series from Harvard, they had a very high response rate from that. And our experience from Mosul, where we did 1,200 households, not a single household refused to talk. And in fact, the problem that the interviewers had was, how do we get people to stop talking? This is a cathartic, this is a therapeutic opportunity to tell you about what's happened to us.
I've had the same experience as a reporter,
yeah.
Interviewing people who've been through some sort of trauma.
Yeah.
You would think, intuition is that they don't want to be bothered, leave them alone, you're being intrusive. But in fact, they do want to talk,
exactly.
And they appreciate the attention.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not that they want their name used or they want any personal benefit out of it. They just want to talk about it.
Dr. Gilbert Burnham is founder of the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins. He led the team that estimated that as many as 655,000 Iraqis may have died after the U.S. invasion of their country in March 2003. More recently, Dr. Burnham was senior author of a report on human mortality during the 9-month battle to liberate the Iraqi city of Mosul from the Islamic State. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast if you get a chance, and review our show on iTunes, your Apple Podcast app, or for Android users on Stitcher. For producer Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes producer and journalist Cyrus Farivar to discuss his new book, Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech, an insightful look at the implications for the future of privacy. Tuesday, June 12th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.